Blog Talk Radio.
As the tears are falling from my face, with all my fears I long for your embrace. How am I gonna carry on and be the one you lead it on when I'm falling down? Now the tears
All right, folks, and welcome to another edition of Continue Mission. We got a little late start, but that's okay, though that happens. I got Rich Kilblaine on here. Want to make sure he can hear me okay. I think he can. We'll see. How about now, Rich? Are we good to go?
I'm reading you loud and clear.
Oh, man, that's even better. So, oh, wow. What a great show last week, and not just because I wasn't on, but but it was really good. I got a lot of good comments about the show last week. People learned a lot about logistics last week, and while some people may think it's dry and not informational, I'm going to tell you, I think there were a lot of people that were sincerely interested in listening, you know, for a professional development way, because, you know, I didn't get a chance to listen to the show. I was in Vegas.
Mind, I'm going to be teaching a college course on military logistics at CNU in the fall. So actually, I joked about this when I would teach the lieutenants, and I said, why aren't there that many, a lot written about military logistics? And
mm-hmm.
Someone's always going to say, because it's boring. And I said, it's so boring, you're going to make a career at it. I said,
yeah.
The problem is, logistics is not boring. When you understand logistics, everything in a military operation begins to make sense. I think the real problem is most military historians do not understand logistics. So they don't know how it
yeah.
works. And
yeah,
so
thank
for
God.
Them to write about it, it's boring.
Yeah.
So thank
God that we don't, you know, I think that's the problem with the Russian army. They didn't know nothing about logistics either. And, you know, and
I will
see
you,
this.
There's, yeah, no one does logistics on the scale that we do. Okay.
Yeah.
Many of our coalition partners in Iraq and Afghanistan had to rely on us for transportation and supply. Okay, so our NATO partners, the main ones like England, France, they were good with their logistics, but their armies were small. In fact, you remember Paul Fish, okay?
Major oh, yeah,
Paul
I just
Fish,
talked to him, actually.
The,
I just talked
okay,
to him.
Oh, okay, but anyway,
yeah.
he was from the British Army, attached to 7th Transportation Group in Iraq. Or at Kuwait. And I always, both of us, you and I, really, really enjoyed talking with him. He's really interesting guy. And he really loved the opportunity to be the operations officer for 7th Group because he was put in charge of the move of the Black Watch.
Sure.
The blocking position for the Battle of Fallujah.
Dude, I would
and
that happened.
Yeah, I know. You provided escort for him. That's how you got to meet him. But the thing was, and he told me this, he said he had more HETs, heavy equipment transporters, the tank haulers. He had more HETs in that convoy than the entire British Army did, okay? Mm-hmm. He's like, he got to do things he would have never gotten to do in his army, okay?
Yeah. Well, let me just tell you, you guys did a great job. I mean, obviously, I'm not sure, you know, I just know that talking to people that listen to the show, they enjoyed the show, man. I mean, so, you
well,
know, that's
make
really
sure
cool.
Mark knows that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm
make
sending
sure
Mark a message because I'm surprised, you know, I haven't heard from Mark. And I really, you know, I mean, he's extremely intelligent. I mean, he's extremely intelligent. And you know, we have the discussion, you know, he says, And I tell him, look, Mark, you were a much better logistics officer than I was. And he says, you were a better combat arms guy. So it's like, imagine if you put those two brains and operations together in a functional environment. You know, I mean, I think that's the way we need to do business, you know, from here on out. I think that
well, no, I'm going to disagree in logistics. The tactical mindset is needed at the company level
Mm-hmm.
But when you get battalion and above, you got to start thinking operational, okay? Because battalion commanders don't roll on convoys. Company commanders hardly roll on convoys, but the company commanders have to train their people, the lieutenants in this, in the NCOs, to think tactically. But at the battalion level, they're thinking operation. They're thinking from end to end. Your battalion commanders weren't rolling in on the convoys with you. Your sergeant major kept. They have to sit there and look at how they're going to supply all those units in Iraq. So they're focusing more at the operational level. And, you know, you fortunately, because you were enlisted, that you were going to retire by the time you made major. And you never pinned on. You keep bragging about how you got out as a captain, but you're actually a major, but you never pinned on. Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, all your experience, you know, you were only assigned to a battalion in a holding position waiting for an assignment. You've never done battalion staff, let alone general staff, you know. So all your time was at the tactical level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah, but, you know, it is what it is. I mean, look, I definitely had a conflict with the spit and polish guys and, the S shop guys. You know, and I did work in the S shop for a while. I mean, I did go to battalion headquarters, worked in the S2, S3 shop and the S4 shop. But, you know, it just wasn't my game, man. I mean, I went as far as I needed to go. 22 years, it was time to go. You know what I mean? And I think that if more people
that was the thing is your skill set, you were where you needed to be. You needed to be where you could train soldiers, okay? Train truck drivers.
Yeah. But anyways, you know, I think that, you know, and Mark, you know, him and I talked about this whole thing, you know, the things that he went through. And I don't know. It was really sad because, you know, I mean, I'm not sure what goes on in the mindset of some people, you know. I mean, it just, you know, not everybody is made to be a combat arms or, but my God, if anybody's learning a lesson about logistics right now, it should be the whole world watching the Russian army and that big cluster that's going on over there. You know, I mean, they are absolutely, I mean, they're losing vehicles, weapons. I mean, there was a TikTok video of some, you know, U.S. Army veteran that went over there and was bragging about stealing a BMP and was laughing and joking about it. I mean, just went and took it from the Russians. They were wherever they were at. Who knows where they were at, you know, but stole their vehicle. And it was just, there's just stuff laying everywhere. And for me, you know, I think that they definitely lack, you know, logistical knowledge. And I think that that's why that they try to gobble up other countries. I really do. Think about World War II. What were they doing when they went into Germany? They were trying to get all the scientists, all the doctors, because they didn't have it, you know, and they wanted it. And I see them, you know, now at this point where, you know, all of those guys are dead now. You know, most of their knowledge in these other fields, you know, everything's focused on very singular things. You know, I mean, nobody's they definitely don't have no multifunctional
location.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to look at this from a different perspective. And that is not so much why the Russian army is so poor at logistics, but why are we so good at it? Because most of the other countries are not that good either. I think it's because of the education program that we have and the professionals and the fact that, you know, as I look at, you know, I'm the guy that writes the history, mm-hmm. and my history is about, you know, all those majors and lieutenant colonels that were running logistics in the beginning of the Iraqi Freedom War were all captains and lieutenants in 7th Group during Somalia and Haiti, all these small operations. You know, I'm writing about these guys when they're young lieutenants and captains, and then they all grow up to be these majors and lieutenant colonels in the next war. They know logistics, all right? They have actual combat experience. Well, no, it was contingency experience. That's what I should say. Operational and contingency experience with logistics. Because here's the thing. It doesn't change. I mean, for a logistician, it doesn't matter whether it's a training mission or a combat mission or a humanitarian mission. On a training mission, if they don't get the bullets, soldiers don't train or get the bullets or the gas. If they don't in combat, if they don't get the bullets, or the consequences are higher. They die. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So, but these guys, you know, have to deliver the goods, and Mark Ruffing made a career at that.
Yeah, he did, and he was. If there was anybody that you wanted, you know, to ensure that logistics was properly accounted for and assure supplies and things were properly done, it was that guy. Now, some people may not like the way he did things, but I understood that everybody had, you know, their specialties. And he was just one of these guys. It was just black or white with him, man. It's the way
it
is.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you right now.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I was a support platoon leader when I was in a mech battalion, and I was in charge of, I handled ammo, fuel, and food. I was in charge of the field mess, and then they eventually gave me the dining facility. So I was in charge of 1, 3, and 5, food, fuel, and ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, I was good at that tactical level logistics. But that whole supply system confused me. And from that time on, I didn't want to have anything to do with logistics. When I got to, after I finished my special forces time, I was assigned to 7th ID. And I was assigned to a brigade. And I wrote them. And I said, look, I'm coming in April. What jobs you got open? And they said, we have an S4 and an S3 air. And I said, I would really like to have that S3 air job. And they said, well, you coming out of Cass Cube, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was a interim level, military education course, really good at the time. You know, in fact, when I went through it, it was in its early years where they put quality team leaders in charge of it. But they said, you're qualified to do any staff job. And I'm going, yeah, but I'm more qualified because I come out of war plans. I said, but I'm really stressing. I'd be much better in that operational job. And I got it. I wanted to avoid because I knew how hard logistics was.
Right.
Mindset. But after 18, actually, I would say after 10 years as a Transportation Corps historian, I began to get it. I began to understand the operational side of the logistics. And it was also during that time frame that I actually got sent to, you know, the times I went to Iraq and Afghanistan, I was just focusing on transportation. But I took the quartermaster historian with me my last trip. And so that exposed me to the other logistical functions. And it was the next year that the Haiti earthquake relief operation took place, and I got sent down there to cover all logistics. But by that time, I got it. I even understood mortuary affairs. It's a different thought process, and so I'm going to teach that. That's my goal, is to develop a course. You know, the ROTC, they get tactics all the time, but no one teaches them logistics yet. I'm developing a course, and I hope, I'll probably end up writing the textbook on it, and I hope that a lot of other colleges will adopt this, okay?
Yeah. Well, hopefully. You know, you hope so. I mean, that's the you know, the reality is that, you know, it's important. It's an, you know, it's definitely turn on the news right now, you know, and just watch everything going on. I mean,
like, well, like I said, I'm going to start this class off with, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and in particular, the drive toward Kiev. And I'm going to say, we do logistics right. Russia can't even get 100 miles to Kiev, and we were able to go 500 miles from our log base in Kuwait to Baghdad. And we knew when and where we would run out of water.
Well,
and
fuel. Listen, the soldiers
and we planned accordingly.
The soldiers
so,
do that.
So
the
that operation went pretty much, I guess the only thing that go ahead.
When we were in Desert Storm, we were hauling butt up the MS, you know, hauling butt, you know, and we knew that every 300 miles we would run out of gas. The soldiers knew that. There was nobody surprised and ran out of gas. It just it just didn't happen. Now, we had a lot of guys get stuck up in the mud trying to go across the desert, you know, when it started raining. But our biggest, the issue with logistics was never an issue. I mean, that was back in 1991, man, you know? So I think
no. See, the thing is, we know that we planned accordingly. So we know, like, okay, at this point they're going to look. A tank and a truck can only go so far on a tank of gas. Now, what's interesting, and Ruffing and I, Mark and I, discussed that last show was that the fuel truck drivers were literally getting ahead of the tanks. It wasn't a case like where the tanks are coming back to top off. The trucks were pulling, were driving ahead of the tanks, pulling off to the side of the road. So when the tanks were low on gas, they would fill up. They would pull over like a truck, like a gas station, and fill up directly from these these, you know, big tankers.
Yeah, it was. Hey, look, it's definitely a skill set that that you know is definitely has. Need not just in the military, but hey, man, in corporations. This is
well, that's the whole point. Most of the officers I know that go logistics do so because of that very reason.
Yeah,
because you're getting a crash course as a lieutenant. You're going to be in charge of people and equipment. That you would never get that experience starting out with in the corporate world, okay? And so, yeah, these guys do. Well, actually, you know, they – well, a lot of them do get out, but I just know most of them I know really enjoy logistics. They stay in for the 20, and then they get out and prosecute their talents to the highest bidder.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know – I talked to Paul Fish. You know, he's on LinkedIn, by the way. By the way,
where is he? The last I heard from him, he was planning to live here in the United States.
No, he's back in the UK. I'll have to send him a message, though. I mean, that's the last time.
Right.
I just talked to him a couple of weeks ago. But so let's, you know, I really want to dive into a couple of topics tonight. But that was a good one to kick it off. Because last week's show was really good, and it wasn't dry, it wasn't boring. At least, you know, it appealed to a different crowd. It did. And so I think that we brought in newer listeners that were wanting to hear that. And I think Mark brings a little bit of a following with him as well. So his transformation is one that I really would like to get. You know, and I was interviewed last night on a YouTube show called Marshall in the Middle. Go to YouTube and you type in Marshall in the Middle. You know, you can pull up some of the interviews he does. Now, he was actually my Office Basic course platoon. So he was an E7, and him and I are like almost exactly the same age. As a matter of fact, I'm a little bit older than him. So when I came in there, you know, obviously, you know, the gray hair always throws you off, you know, as a second lieutenant. But it was a great show last night, and we got into talking about the war and about, you know, the different aspects. And I really had a good opportunity to talk about some of the great soldiers that I got to serve with, you know. And, of course, you know when I bring that up, you know, there's names that come up. There's, you know, Brian Noble, Jody Cuthbertson, Rob Landry, and, you know, Aaron Manis. And then there's several others that I like to talk about because their stories are so unique. But I also mentioned Mark Ruffing because of the transition to accept the price. I think he was always a Christian, but I think that he really threw himself and it allowed him to open up and to communicate. And I look forward to conversations with him. I really do. And it's an interesting aspect. Of life, you know, you go through this cycles. Let's just call them cycles, you know, where we get to a speed and we no longer want to deal with drama and nonsense. You know what I mean? We just okay give other people credit things and to talk good about it. You don't have to always be negative. And I think this day and age is just so much negative, so much. I really like to brag on these guys, and I serve them. I really do. I like bragging up, and I really like to talk about lifestyles now, you know, how he changed and became these wonderful, you know, great people that they are today, you know, fathers and grandfathers and mothers even, you know, because we had some ladies that did that job as well. And for me, going to be the highlight, and I think I'm gonna really try hard to start bringing some of these guys on this show with us, so we can highlight their life. You know what I mean? And the good things that they've done. You know, because I think about so many of them served and were such selfless servants, and they never got recognized properly. And it really bothers me. To this day, it's hard for me to even deal with, because if things were truly fair, you know, we would have had half a dozen Silver Star recipients and probably, you know, and probably even more, you know, BSM with V recipients and maybe even some DSC recipients, because there were some really, really heroic things that occurred while I was in service. Out, I want us to pick one guy tonight and talk about him, and I will make him shine. Maybe we can do three. What do you think? Are you with me, Rich?
Yeah. No, I'm listening.
So, can you tell the story of April Uprising? So, 2004, you know, the war in Iraq. Who comes to mind, you know, in your, as a historian? You wrote about all of these folks, but what are some, who are some of those soldiers that come to mind that really, really gutted it out?
Well, James, it was the 11 people who went to the wall, okay? It was you and the crew of the Zebra. It was Tom Stewart. I forgot who went with him, his
Tom
partner.
Butler.
And
Chris Marion. And,
yeah, and then the guys on the Eve of Destruction, too. Yeah, so
yep.
They pulled up, all right? But they were all taking direction from you. So, yeah,
but,
that's,
but you know,
I mean.
There is a certain of heroism in these men, and you know, I'm focusing on, you know, I'd like to focus on them.
Well,
like
James, hold it, stop. All right, let's describe heroism. Let's talk talk about that. First of all, what is heroism? And I'll tell you why you guys didn't get the medals.
Yeah, well, heroism is you know, doing what you need to do even when it has, you know, very serious dangers involved, you know, but doing the right thing.
Doing your job
when
there's a
job.
Risk of getting killed. Okay.
Yeah,
that's why Miser didn't give you guys all those medals. Because when he read what you're doing, his response was, well, they're just doing their job.
Right.
Now, I have, you know, been studying heroism. Now, first of all, let me point out, hero is always used in the third person. It's always used to refer to somebody else. And guys like Jake McNeese, those World War II paratroopers that jumped in, they will tell you the heroes are those that didn't come back. The ones they look up to are those that made the ultimate sacrifice. They got killed. Then, you know, now when we think heroism, we're thinking of somebody doing something who is conquering their fear. See, everybody gets scared. Anyone who doesn't get scared in combat is they're probably dangerous or crazy, but everybody experiences fear. It's what you do with that. It's what you do with it.
Let me do
your job,
yeah,
or do you hide? Okay,
you know,
as I would study these guys who received earned the Medal of Honor and DSEs and stuff, and I sent you one. I finally found a Vietnam transporter who received the only Distinguished Service Cross from Vietnam. And he got it. I read the citation. They got caught in an ambush. They dismounted, got in the ditch, and then he realized no one had called in the ambush. So he leaves his position of safety. He goes to his Jeep. He calls in the ambush and support. He gets wounded. Then he returns to his position and returns fire to the enemy, and then he gets killed. All right, I'm sitting there going, the way this is written, I didn't see anything that earned even a Silver Star, okay? But the fact is, he got killed. And when you get killed, that elevates the risk level. Now, the fact is, the intensity of that fire, the enemy fire, could have. See, it's the degree of risk. Now, but I will, you know, whenever I either read the accounts of the Medal of Honor recipients or listen to the guys talk, they always say the same thing. I don't know what the big deal was. I don't know what the fuss was. I was just doing my job. I kept hearing that over and over again. So I was interviewing Tom Stewart, and he ran to the wall. Now, his company took care of his guys. All those guys from his company that went to the wall got their Bronze Stars. Everybody else, it took us, what? Well, we got them submitted. You know, I think you have a limit of 2 years. But it took 10 years before you finally got your Silver Star. It was a long, drawn-out battle.
Yeah.
And the thing was, Tom turned to me and he goes, did I deserve, you know, do you think I really deserve the Bronze Star? And I'm looking at him like, so when you, all right, you got to understand, Tom Stewart, he was in remember they had the internet cafes, and he was there. Mm-hmm. He was typing a message to a friend of his who had sent him a GameCube, and he's going, hey, thanks for the GameCube. And then he heard the gunfire. He says, got to go get an ambush. Or he said, get an ambush, got to go. Boom, hits in. Ran, because he had his M16, ran to his truck. He was on that convoy with you that fought his way in.
Yeah.
In fact, that he took over the gun truck where they had three gunners get wounded. Remember?
Yeah,
so he
took over that.
You know, they had to wash out the blood of that truck. So he took over that gun truck. So he goes running, racing. And when he gets to his gun, his Humvee, like no armor on it, all his crew is there. and they're swapping out M16s for SAWs, and then they run to the wall. Now, you would think this is all instantaneous. No, you're up there on the wall fighting for 5 to 10 minutes before you start seeing anybody show up. And the first people you see showing up is Tom Stewart and those other guys, right? And I sit there and I said, Tom, when you were running to the wall, did you look left and right? He goes, yeah. And I said, what did you see? He said, well, I saw all these people running the other way and hiding behind their trucks. And I said, now, that should have given you a hint that something's wrong here. So you're running towards the wall, and everybody else is running the other way.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what was going through your mind? He goes, I couldn't understand why they were doing that, because we, you know, our job is to get to the wall, defend it. If they break through, they'll kill us. I said, and that's when it hit me. We don't use the term heroes. Warriors do not do risk assessments. Warriors do not say, if I do this and I do that, then I'll survive. What? No, they don't. All a warrior does is ask, what's the right thing to do? Tom Stewart knew it was to run to that wall. Now, why he got the Bronze Star? Because everybody else was running the other direction, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the fact is, like, you're up there on that, you know, what is missing from your Silver Star is that for 45 minutes you're sitting on top of that Humvee. Well, actually, you weren't up there for 45 minutes because they replaced you with the Okay, so you were sitting on the 50 cal, and then they would swap you out, and then you go up and you're firing your M16. But you're on that ramp for about 45 minutes. What the awards committee, well, I don't think they really even care. I think they were just upset that this was a submitted late and that they actually had to take action on it, because there's a lot of politics involved in the awards. But they couldn't comprehend the intensity of that fight.
Yeah.
So a lot that has to do with it, all these guys now, after interviewing Tom Stewart about his fight on the wall, I realized that warriors don't do risk assessments, what we would call a hero, valor. Is not necessarily okay. So we hear the case of the guy running up there, you know, by himself and taking out the enemy. Well, he's doing what everybody else should have been doing. Everybody should have been running up there to take out the enemy. But we have one guy who's doing his job, and he stands out. People, we make heroes.
And, yeah.
So it comes down to, all these guys are just doing the Medal of Honor recipients were just doing their jobs. That's all. They were just doing their job. The problem is the risk level. It's two things I found, and I wrote this paper on it. It is one, the level of risk, and two, the number of lives saved or the number of lives taken. Okay. Had Alvin York only captured 35 Germans, he probably would have gotten a Distinguished Service Cross. But he captured 135 Germans, so he gets the Medal of Honor.
Wow.
So it's the level of risk, it's the level of it, how many lives you took, how many lives you saved. That's what I've learned in my years of studying valor.
Right. No, I get you, man, and it's anyway. Hey, it's pretty cool. It's I appreciate you writing that book. I do, or that paper. The thing is that we have to mention their names. You know what I mean? You have it's just like when we talk about people that have given their lives for this country. You know, I mean, it's like you keep them alive and you keep that going by telling their names, and it's just. You know, it's just like when people talk about the defense of the wall at BIOP, it's Lieutenant McCormick and the Zebra Crew. And the Zebra Crew actually included, you know, Anthony Richardson, Brian Noble, Ralph Blue, you know, and Brandon Lawson. And they have names, you know, and they're actual real people that, you know, go through through life, and very few know the remarkable things that they did, because let me tell you, there were other officers out there that were trying to get, you know, and many will tell you, they try to get soldiers to do things or that they're supposed to do, and they don't do it, you know, and they're, you know, they get stumped with it. And I know a lot of infantry officers that got stuck, you know, with guys that are like, well, you know, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that. The point that I'm making is that it takes the individual to step up. And for me, I think I was very blessed because my entire crew had a Spartan-like spirit in them.
Right. Well, there's a funny reason why. Because, mm-hmm. All right, you were grounded. You were grounded. Your convoy, your platoon rolled out the gate without you. That was April 5th. And that's when Al Sadr called for a jihad against coalition forces. And it was an NTO from another company. Because everybody considered you reckless. You were reckless.
Yeah.
You know, you were a fucking bullet magnet, all right? I mean, see, everybody at that time was thinking, clear the kill zone. And you're turning around going back into it. You're a hazard, so you were grounded. But then when there was a call for a jihad against coalition forces, there was a sergeant from another company came over in Ohio.
Yeah, they did,
You know, it's like, I think I need you Rupert. On my convoy. Yeah. And here's the funny part about it is
groovy.
So,
that's what we call it, man.
So mm-hmm. tell everybody about going back to, you know, Pat Hinton and asking to go out after he's grounded you using the excuse that you were wounded.
Which that was not.
What did he say?
That was true. That was true. But he relented and let me go and said that I could pick my own crew. So I've handpicked my crew.
Wait. No, you're making it sound like you get to pick it. No, the way I understand it was he said that you could only go out with people that would volunteer to go with you. There's a difference between picking your own crew sounds like there's a lot of people wanting to go ride with you, okay? But it was, no, it's who will ride with you. There's two ways to ask that question, okay?
No, you're right.
So let's talk about the guys who, like, will ride with this. Okay, one, there's a jihad against coalition forces. If you cross the border, you're going to get ambushed. And you're riding with a lieutenant who drives back into the kill zone, okay? Mm-hmm. You're probably going to get wounded. Who in their right mind is going to ride with you, James? So then now that's the context. Now tell me about the guys that volunteered to go with you.
Well, I mean, you know, obviously Brian Noble, that was a given. You know, I mean, listen.
Well, why? What in Brian Noble's background would make him want to go with you?
Well, he was a bounty hunter, okay?
Right.
And
the guy was already an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, okay. 6'4", I mean, a Viking looking, you know, but let me tell you, he wasn't reckless. And here's the thing, he was, you know, Brian could have been a professional football player or something like that. I mean, he just had that size about him. But what he was he was deadly serious about his job. He was. And it was, you know, and the thing was, is we had been together long enough at that point to where I didn't have to tell him to turn left, turn right, go here, go. I didn't have to do that. He knew. Literally, we could just look and he said, I know what you're thinking. And, you know, and he'd go right where I needed him to go. I mean, that is the kind of person that he was. And then, of course, I recruited Ralph Blue from Florida. And what a great guy that was. He was a former Marine infantry guy, you know. And he was in the Army Reserve working in the TOC. And he's like, hey, man, I got to get out of here, you know. I was like, well, you can come with me. And then Brandon Lawson.
No. Let's just talk about that. So you got a former Marine in a truck battalion talk, and he's like, and this is his first war, right? It's his first war, and he hasn't seen any action. He hasn't pulled a trigger, and he's got an opportunity to go out and roll with his lieutenant.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he wanted to go,
okay.
Man.
Sorry.
Yeah, he wanted to go, man. He really wanted to go. And
He's a Marine.
Yeah, he's a Marine.
He's never
stopped being a Marine. Yeah, he never stopped being a Marine. And you know, he went, and then, of course,
all right,
Brandon.
So your crew right now, your crew is a bounty hunter and a former Marine, okay? Tell me about the other guy.
Well, the other one was Brandon Lawson. Now, Brandon, you know, he was young. He was just young, but he was strong. You know, he was kind of built like he was a little bit shorter, about 5'7". But, I mean, he had arms as big as your legs, man. I mean, this guy was, you know. So when I looked at these guys, it's like I need to make sure we got people that can fight, you know, that are going to be able to fight.
Right, right. So what was it about Brandon? What was it about Brandon that?
Yeah, he was a scrappy kid. That was the thing. He was scrappy, didn't take no lip from nobody, and he was ready to fight, man. I mean, his attitude, some people didn't like his attitude. His attitude worked just fine with me because I wasn't asking him to shine nobody's boots or to kiss nobody's hind end. I'm asking you to go to war, you know, go into battle with us and engage and destroy the enemy.
That sounds exactly like Jake McNeeson, the Filthy 13th, right? All right,
yeah.
So you got your crew. Now you're going to pick up one more guy. You're going to pick up an armorer, right?
He was a former Marine.
Once you get the
file, by the way.
There you go. Now his story is funny because the first sergeant promised his mother what?
That he wouldn't let him get hurt. Yeah.
Okay, he's an armorer. He's not supposed to leave the arms room. He checks out weapons and turns them back in, right?
Well,
what the hell is he doing on a convoy? What's he doing on a convoy?
Well, look, weapons break down in the field, man. You need them guys in the field, you know.
No. Well, actually, yeah, we did. My armorer was in my company in the field with me, too. But the point being was, no, he volunteered to go out, right?
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, absolutely.
He didn't have to go out. He had a job that did not require him to go on the road, but he wanted to go on the road.
And, you know, let me tell you something that's really sad about his situation. He got a Purple Heart. You know, he got an Army Commendation Medal with V, and then they revoked it because they were going to upgrade it to the BSM. He never got the BSM. It was crazy. And, you know, that aggravated him. And look, here's the
I know. And, you know, the thing is, he took the same risk all you guys took that got BSMs. No idea why they downgraded it to ARCOM with V. All right, but let's get past that. So now you've got your crew of guys who are almost suicidal. All right, so you're going to have you leave Kuwait with 4-man crew. You're going to pick up a 5th man. Out of 5 men, how many of them get wounded on that mission?
Say again, how many of us got wounded?
How many of them will get wounded? How many of those 5 are going to receive Purple Hearts?
4.
Yeah, all but one of them is going to get a Purple Heart.
And Lawson,
they were about to medevac him, and he broke down crying and refused to go. You had to make a deal with the medics
that you guys would take care of. Yeah, it was the doctor, because the doctor was, you know, had basically told me to stand down on this. You know what I mean? And I just explained, you know, I mean, like, we're just going to be here in the base camp, you know, so if we need you, we can bring him back. I mean, is it really that important? And it wasn't like he needed surgery, you know, but now he got thudded pretty good in the thigh.
All right.
I mean,
now, that's your ambush going into biop, right? So you're making the doctor, you're promising the doctor, hey, he's not going to do anything to infect that. And then you end up fighting on the wall.
Yeah, well, the doctor never found that out. So we just he might have had me court-martialed. You know what I mean? I don't know, but
yeah. No, but look, I saw a it wasn't a documentary. I think it was like a video, a story of one of the caches at BIOP. And And it shows the guy breaking down crying when he finds out he's getting sent back to Landstuhl.
Yeah.
And the doctor is explaining, he said, this is so common. He says, none of them want to leave. He said, we have to force them out of here. He said, they don't want to leave. They don't want to leave their buddies.
Right.
And so, yeah, that doctor is so used to you. No, that weekend. No, you're right. Until that weekend, the attacks had not been that intense.
Yeah.
So that was probably new. That was probably a new experience for those surgeons.
Well, they were overwhelmed. By the time we got in the hospital that Thursday night, they were overwhelmed. By Friday, it was chaotic. I mean, and you know, there were 109 soldiers, airmen and sailors and Marines, whatever, was killed during that time period. You know, if you look at that whole 19-day period, it was a week period. During that week, there was 109. So it was actually the highest casualty week ever in the history of OIF. The week, not the year, but the week.
Yeah, so, right.
And I don't know how many people were wounded, you know, gobs of people, I'm certain. And, you know, probably other people, you know, had they did the traumatic brain injury thing at the time, we'd have probably had, you know, 5,000 more Purple Heart recipients, you know, in the Al-Anbar province, maybe more, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Ralph Blue, in all seriousness, probably should have got the Purple Heart because, you know, he did get an injury in under fire in his hand. His whole hand was sliced open. I don't know if you knew that or not, but
no.
But yeah, it was.
Wait, so you're saying the only guy that didn't get a Purple Heart should have got a Purple Heart?
Yeah, he should have got a Purple. I think so. But when he went to the medic, you know, he wasn't sure what happened. But, you know, he wasn't sure how it happened. You know, was it when you were switching out magazines or what? Because, you know, we were going through, you know, 30-round magazines like crazy. But, you know, he was the coolest. He was one of the coolest dudes, man. He really was. Because he would say, Lieutenant McCormick. He said, this reminds me of Gilligan's Island, a 3-hour cruise that's turned into a lifetime commitment.
That never ends. Never ends.
Yeah. Oh, God, he's still funny, man. I sometimes we just call each other just to hear each other's voice, you know what I mean? Just because I miss him. I really miss him. And it's like, I got to go.
Well, you shared an experience that nobody else will ever understand.
Yeah, they still are great guys, you know what I mean? And some of them are troubled, you know what I mean? Some of them, they go through their, and I think it's because, I really think that a lot of it is because they really, you know, they had to, especially when they went over to the, you know, we went over to the 518th after this, and, you know, they went back to their units, and they were treated like crap by their units in most cases. They were treated like crap, man. They really were. The 1486 and the 86 was the exception. I think that they really set the example on how to take care of your
troops.
Is that
the one Tom Stewart was in?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right, because they got all their guys.
They did.
They
Doug
interviewed
Wilhelm
them when they came back, and they submitted all the guys for medals. They did it right. There was one
Doug
company
Wilhelm.
From Ohio.
Yeah, Doug Wilhelm, the commander, was just super fantastic about ensuring, and he saw the importance of it. And you know, so did Denton to a certain degree. And Ron Parton was very, you know, he was just a good dude, man. He was a good dude, too.
When you say Hinton was, he was a talk bitch, okay? On the battle staff, okay? He was not in a position to take care of medals, but he was
our commander.
One of the few people that was paying attention to what the hell was going on.
Yeah, you're talking.
That's how he knew about you.
You're talking about Landry. You were talking about Landry. Yeah.
Oh, Landry. Excuse me.
Yeah, Hinton.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
Hinton was your company commander. You're right.
Yeah.
I got confused. You're right.
And he did to a certain degree, but there was too much politics in that unit, and so it's like, well, if a soldier, all they had to do, and there was a lot of jealousy in that unit. I didn't see as much. I didn't see the jealousy like I. You know, in the 1486, I just didn't see it. Those people in that unit were genuinely proud to stand up and say, that's one of my soldiers that's getting decorated, even though they never got the medal, but they felt the pride in that and they saw the significance. This is good for the unit. This is good for the army.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is good for morale.
Yeah. Look, I want to point something out.
Yeah.
That someone told me this, and this surprised me. He said, you can tell a good unit by the number of awards, medals, and punishments that are issued out. And I'm sitting there, I was surprised. I mean, so if you look to a unit and you see a lot of Article 15s and court-martials, but you see a lot of medals being issued, I'm like, that doesn't sound right. And so, and the person explained to me, he said, it means the leadership is paying attention. They reward their soldiers when they do good. They punish them when they do bad. And I remember one colonel, lieutenant battalion commander in 7th Group, who you either loved him or hated him. And if you were one of those bad soldiers, he was after you. He was riding your ass, you know. But if you were a good soldier, you were getting lots of medals. And in that unit, there was a lot of awards and there was a lot of punishments. So it comes down to the leadership paying attention to what their soldiers do and taking pride.
Yeah, I mean, and look, we had some guys, you know, obviously we had some guys that got in trouble. We had a little bit of that going on. But, you know, here's the deal. Those, as whatever you want to say about the transportation units, they performed a hell of a mission over there. And for them to leave theater and not even get a meritorious unit citation for
Let me explain that.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go inside because I'm outside and now we're getting thunder, okay? So I'm having trouble hearing. Yeah, but all right. So being a former infantry and special forces officer and having been a transporter, here's the thing I observed. And this is the thing I would tell these lieutenants, you know, because they'd come in and not everybody wanted to be a transporter. A lot of them wanted to go infantry. They wanted to go combat arms. And I would ask them, how many of you wanted to go how many of you volunteered for transportation corps? And so many hands go up. And I said, how many of you, this was not your first choice, you wanted to go combat arms? And all these hands go up. And then I say, if you are a platoon leader of a truck unit in combat, congratulations, you have joined the combat arms.
Mm-hmm.
Because a truck convoy driving through enemy territory, you have to think tactically. That's why I started writing the convoy ambush case studies, because it was a tool to teach convoy commanders to think tactically. So that's what makes the Transportation Corps different from, you know, the rest, you know, the ordnance and quartermaster. Is that these guys go outside the wire and they have to think like combat arms officers. Unfortunately, and Mark Ruffing and I were talking about it, and I said, that was the show that you were on. And I said, that is where the transportation school failed them in those first few years of the war, is we didn't teach them to think tactically. But and that's why a lot of the leadership failed to recognize it, because all those battalion commanders and group commanders, you know, they're like, truck drivers are not heroes. They don't get medals of honor. They don't get distinguished service crosses.
Yeah.
No one was paying attention. Now, I'm going to also add this. So S.L.A. Marshall wrote two books, Men Against Fire and Soldiers Load. And in his book on Men Against Fire, he had one chapter on this subject of awards. And what he pointed out is why a lot of soldiers do not get the recognition they deserve is because the negligence is not malicious. In other words, the commanders aren't paying attention to what happened today because they're focusing on what's going to happen tomorrow and the day after. These guys are so focused on what's going to happen the next few days, most of them are not paying attention to what's happening today, and that is why so many soldiers go, and S.L.A. Marshall was writing this from his experiences in World War II, his observations in World War II. Now, he was a World War I vet, but as he went over to he went to all three theaters of operation as a historian, and that was his observation, and that's what I found. So it's not so much that you had good battalion commander. They gave you guys your Purple Hearts and stuff like that, but they had two problems. One, they had no concept of heroism. They were transporters. They had no idea that they had never experienced, you know, any convoy ambushes. And keep in mind, this is another problem we've discussed, that until recently when they did the review, there has been no Medal of Honor awarded to any living veteran of Iraq. Everybody that got a Medal of Honor was killed in action. Well, and that is because all those guys, you know, when you look at that generation that had to make the decision on who would get what medals, what wars were they fighting as lieutenants and captains? Somalia, Haiti, Kosovo. The only two Medal of Honors that were awarded to two Delta guys that got killed. So when we went into this war, there was a prejudice that the only way you could get a Medal of Honor was posthumously. There was no – see, the Vietnam generation, they were used to – enlisted men with the Medal of Honor. I remember my mentor, who was a Marine, he would tell me there was a corporal. He had this one, a lot of funny stories about this corporal in his unit. And it goes, if anybody, all the listeners out there who've worn the uniform, junk on the bunk. James, what's junk on the bunk?
Yeah, that was you laid everything out. All your field gear.
No, it was you laid out your field gear, your LBE and all that. Junk on the bunk. They come by to inspect to make sure you got all your field gear. Well, so everybody's standing tall next to their bunk, except this Medal of Honor recipient. And he would have, instead of his field gear laid out, he would just leave his Medal of Honor laying on the bunk. And when the first sergeant and the company commander come by, they go, yep, he's got everything, and he moved on. Okay? And but here's this corporal. He's a corporal in the unit, and he's a Medal of Honor. What do you think this is doing? How does this the problem we have today is there any Medal of Honor recipient still wearing the uniform? As far as I know, all the Medal of Honor, the living Medal of Honor recipients were already out of the military when they received the medal.
Right.
We don't have it. You know, we need You know, if you're going to embrace the warrior ethos, you need to have living heroes. And you need to have living heroes in your organizations. You've got to meet these guys. And there's another story he told me is they would go to the club, the NCO club.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy would walk in, he would sit down, and the bartender would bring him his drink. He would drink like two or three beers, and then he would get up and leave, and he'd never pay for one.
Right.
And the reason was because there was a sign-up list, because people signed up to buy his beers.
Right.
And he didn't abuse it. He didn't get drunk. He would just come in and have two or three beers. But everybody had already signed up. Like, I'm, you know, you were getting in line. Like, I buy this beer, and the next guy buys this beer. That's an army with living heroes, with Medal of Honor recipients in it. But unfortunately for your generation, mm-hmm. the senior officers, none of them were around who understood that. And, no. You know, it's going to probably take a while to recover from that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, and look, you know, the reality is that irregardless if you give the medals or not, you should at least credit the soldiers. You know what I mean? It's like it's okay to tell them that they've done a good job. It really is. It's okay to do that. And I think that we get caught up in this everybody that serves is a hero thing. And while that may be true to a certain degree, there is the realism that there are some that exceed that standard, you know, of just basic service. And I think, you know, Abraham Lincoln said it best, you know, a nation that does not honor its heroes shall not long endure. And we can see we're almost at the end of it now because, you know, you just look at all the craziness and the bizarre, weirdo crap that's going on all across the country. And who are we emulating? You know, who are we really, really looking to for leadership? Somebody, you know, some kid that cusses somebody out or
wait, James, see, yeah. let's address that. A nation without heroes,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so you and I have battled with the awards branch of the human resource.
Oh, God.
We understand it. And I have submitted your packet for the upgrade of the Silver Stars.
Yeah.
And I don't think any of those Silver Stars were upgraded to Medal of Honors, okay? I mean,
no,
you got two Marines that were obvious Medal of Honor recipients.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, that Marine captain, that
good
what?
For America,
you know, his company
too.
Gets ambushed. He drives. He tells his driver, you know, head to the irrigation ditch. They dismount. They go through the ditch, killing Iraqis, run out of ammunition, pick up their weapons, start killing more Iraqis, run out of ammunition, pick up more weapons. I mean, if that is not Sergeant York, what the hell is? And then there's that Marine Gunny that's fighting in the building during the Battle of Fallujah. He's wounded.
Yeah,
he killed his captain guys. You know, I mean, those are like really obvious. They never, as far as I know, they never got upgraded.
No, they didn't. They got the Navy Cross, but which is, you know.
No,
but you're right.
Got the Navy Cross, yeah. But those were metal. That captain, you know, you're talking about how many weapons? How many times did he run out of ammunition, pick up an enemy weapon?
Oh, yeah. Tom Hardy, yeah, that guy right there, that should have been hands down, man. It was just crazy.
That's right. That is such an obvious Medal of Honor. His whole company is
well, you know,
down
the
on the road.
Him
and his driver is clearing this irrigation ditch.
Well, you know, hey, look, and let me tell you, the kickback on that, they will not upgrade these medals very rarely because
right.
It's
you're right. Because, no, it isn't because of merit. It is because the Army and the Navy and Marine Corps do not want to admit they made a mistake.
Damn right. Yeah, absolutely. That's the problem.
But we want to add one more thing. The review process, why does it take so long?
Oh, God, I don't know.
To award a Medal of Honor. Here's the thing. This is something we're going to get to. Okay, you look at the facts. hey, that captain, clear, should have got a Medal of Honor. All right. So when we're going to review the up, why did that process take years? Did it take a year to go over all the evidence? What else were they looking for, James?
Well, they were checking your background, making sure that
you weren't
embarrassment. Yeah.
That's right. Right. So Valor is no longer the single issue for a high award. What is now when the Army and the Navy and Marine Corps are now looking at who they're going to award Medal of Honors to, what is the additional criteria? It's not valor. It's not solely valor. What else is it?
No, it's your stage presence and you know, basically what you look like.
Yeah, that's right. Because whoever receives the Medal of Honor has a voice. Come on, turn on Fox. I mean, look, we have these Medal of Honor recipients. I'm like, what does this guy know about this subject? You know, his criteria is he got a Medal of Honor. You know, at one point, look, see, I've studied the medal. There's what I will call the casual hero, the guy, the opportune, you know, all of a sudden, at that moment, he rose to the occasion. Now, there's these guys I've known who are continuous. Every time they go into action, they perform the same way. Okay? But there's some guys who, like, one time under these extreme circumstances, they rise to the occasion. But that doesn't necessarily make them an expert on Russian logistics, okay, in the invasion to Ukraine. But Fox will have these guys on to talk about it.
Yeah.
Why? Because that medal gave them a platform to speak from.
Yeah.
The Army knew it. The Navy knew it. The Marine Corps knew it. And so when they go to when someone is submitted for the Medal of Honor, for all you listeners out there, the valor is not the sole consideration. In fact, I don't even think it's the primary consideration. I think now everybody's doing the awards branch is doing a background check on these guys, find out if they might possibly embarrass.
Well,
the Army or the Navy, the Marine Corps.
Well, look, I've heard they've done credit checks and everything else, you know what I mean, which, you know, has nothing to do with it. But
when you say you've heard, that's because you've had people in HRC, the awards branch, who have told you. Because, you know, we probably don't need to get into – they were actually – you've been warned that they were looking at fucking with your retirement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
yeah, it gets very political. Awards you get to the high awards, Distinguished Service Cross. Look, Jeremy Church for the Good Friday ambush was submitted for the Distinguished Service Cross. We have been told by a general officer that they downgraded to a silver star because he was a reservist.
Right.
That comes from an insider. That comes from a general officer who is in the know. Okay?
That's correct. Yeah, that's true.
Well, you don't know. You understand the process. But you didn't have... So we in the museum, we were the ones, you know, as a historian and stuff, we're researching it. We were informed by that general.
Yeah,
officer.
Told me about that. Yeah, guys.
Right.
I remember
right.
when you brought that to our attention. I mean that is true, because you know, look, because he was a reservist. Man, come on, man, that's just stupid. You know, it's like
it is.
But that's the way that things go. You know, in this politically, and it's worse now. Let me tell you, it is worse now in this administration than I've ever seen it before in my life. You know, look, all you have to do, I mean, there's so many bullshit in Washington, D.C. right now. I'm just going to tell you, this. All 140, 50, 60,000 listeners out there, listen to me. not everybody that's standing up and speaking in Washington, D.C. is always truthful.
Wait. Tell me who is. Actually, no. There are a lot. Okay, I'm going to tell you. There are a lot of honest politicians, but they are not in the limelight. The one, if you want to get the media to pay attention to you, to lie. You have to exaggerate.
Sure, yeah. You know, I heard the most ridiculous story. I mean, you know, I deal with all these veterans groups, and, you know, in D.C., they have all these committees, and there's some really good people on there. And I was talking to the commander of another veterans group, and I won't say his name, but he has a very severely, you know, wounded son that was, you know, no joke, you know, lost half his brain. I mean, he's a lifetime of care for them. And he's a veteran, too. And him and I were talking, you know, we went to Washington together. We just kind of gravitated towards each other. And then when I found out about his son, you know, being a Purple Heart recipient, and, you know, it's like, you know, that's what we should do, is try to help them as the commander of the military or the Purple Heart. And we started watching, you know, some of these guys that they got representing these organizations. And let me tell you, some of you smaller organizations especially really need to vet some of these people. We had kicked a guy out of our organization. I mean, I'm not going to say his name, but we've kicked quite a few out. But we kicked this one guy out in particular. And he lives in and around, you know, he can be he's real close to D.C. And, you know, he's one of those swamp rats, you know, that just always, and you see him, you know, they gravitate to that location. You know, and look, every agency's always looking for a veteran, for a quarter or a half, and they just get in and they tell these stories. They're stolen valor, a lot of them are, because, you know.
No. He's a veteran. That's not stolen valor. It's exaggerated valor.
Well, no, in this case, it's stolen, yeah. In this case, it was part of the reason why that we let him go. But you know, the thing is that the law protects these people, man. So it's like, so they gravitate. They go to this group, and then they do something stupid, and then they get kicked down to that, and they just continue to make this resume. And Washington's full of them. And I could take you and point out a dozen of them right now that are serving on, you know, different committees. Blue Star families, all of them, you name it. They're all on all of them. And nobody's really checking their background. One of them.
Hey, James, I don't know. I got it. I'm going to tell you something. They're doing something right. Because.
Yeah. Well, obviously. Yeah.
They can milk it. Here it is. They can look. You know,
they're lying.
Got all these posers out there claiming to have been special forces. And
well,
benefiting
that's one of
from
them.
It, profiteering from it, and
yes,
I'm like, it ain't benefiting me for anything.
Look,
bragging rights, I get respect.
Rich,
you know, look, I was special forces because, look, I was young PFC. I got assigned to an SF unit on Okinawa, first group, and I fell in love with it. Best time of my life. I had a blast. I'm like, this is all I want to do from here on out. So I decided to become an officer. And then you have to do your 3 years in the primary branch. It was infantry. And went back to SF. And I'm like, this is it. It was just an adventure.
Well,
you know, I didn't look at it like this great accomplishment. It was like, I'm willing to suffer everything that I have to be able to have that much fun. And I did. I did. And now I was getting ready to get out after that when I got a phone call asked me if I want to go to Fort Ord, California. 7th Infantry Division, and I'm grateful I did because I commanded a great company, and I go to the reunion. I went to my first reunion. Now I'm equals with the soldiers I led. They can tell me the stuff they couldn't tell me when I was a company commander, and I can deal with them in a way that I couldn't as a company commander.
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress.
What I wanted to tell you is that, you know, we've flat out caught these guys. I mean, one of them was passing around pictures saying he was Special Forces. He was in the Green Berets. And it's like,
and that's a red flag right there.
Yeah. He said he was Special Forces. He was Special Forces. And if you go and you know, if you Google him and you look him up, I'm not going to give you his name because there's an active investigation going on right now.
Right.
Him and the other guy who, you know, had just got hired, you know, by this other organization, this other not so well-known organization that, and who knows what they're paying this guy. But they don't realize that, you know, he's got a bullshit story about his Purple Heart.
Right. Oh, which, by the way, okay, here is, because almost all your posers are going to claim to be a Green Beret or SEAL.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'm going to turn the people on.
Here is how you, for the special, anyone claiming to be Special Forces, it's real simple. Contact the Special Forces Association. They can verify. They have a link
to everybody
who is. Yeah, but that's the point. No, for anybody out there and you're going like, how do we prove it? I don't have that. You don't have to go there 2015. No, you go to the. Here's the thing. It's a special. See, to join the Special Forces Association, they have to verify you graduated from the Q course. And they have direct access.
Well,
if you got a guy who claims he was SF, just go to find the Special Forces Association and say, hey, is this guy legit? And they'll look it up. They'll tell you. It's real quick.
Yeah, yeah. No, and we've done that. And the thing is that it takes – because the law is such that if we come out and we would that's fine. If the law say, you know, if we come out and just tell people who they are and what they've done, you know, even though we know the truth, you know, I mean, you'd have 10 or 20 attorneys lined up wanting to sue your organization for telling the damn truth on these people. And it's really disgusting. So we're pushing for a law that, you know, that they really need to do better. But here's all I'm going to say. If you're in Washington, D.C., or you got connections with your senators or your congressmen, and you got these veterans on your staff, you better do a better job at vetting them because we are turning them all into the Stolen Valor Group, every single one of them, and they're going to be investigated. And those guys will out them, you know, humiliate them. And if they're working for, you know, some veterans organization or some congressman or senator, it's going to fall on their shoulders, man. You know, and it should. It really should because
actually, I always joke. The sad thing is, Stolen Valor is not a joke. But I always joke like, because I've interviewed so many Vietnam vets. I said, the problem is, if you're going to claim to have been a Vietnam vet, you're going to claim to have been something like very elite. And this is why in the Transportation Corps, it was easy because no one who is lying about their service is going to have claimed to have been a truck driver in Vietnam. Okay. All right.
Very few people knew about
gun trucks. Very few people knew about gun trucks. So I knew when the people were interviewing, most of what they were saying was true. The only thing I had to deal with was embellishment. But I always joked, I said, if I was wanting to lie about being a Vietnam, because I enlisted in 73, got to Okinawa as everybody's coming back. So I missed the war. I'm a Vietnam era vet. I'm not a Vietnam vet. But if I wanted to lie about being a Vietnam vet, I would claim to have been a member of the 15th Sedan Car Company in Saigon.
The what?
First of all, no one's going to ask any questions about that. What? Okay, there was three sedan car companies in Vietnam. No, the other one would be the 115th Transportation Company at Tonsonut that offloaded, that just They just offloaded cargo. That was it. That's it. They just offloaded cargo and loaded cargo. They just ran forklifts back and forth. You know, I'd pick a unit that, like, that no one's like, I don't even want to hear your story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, or the 105th.
But unfortunately, a poser. Okay, the problem is posers,
yeah,
seek attention, and they want the attention by being the best that they can possibly be.
Well,
you know,
they,
like,
they,
oh, I was a gray, I was a ranger, you know, I was this or that, okay? Not being there, saying, okay, I was in the 15th Sedan Car Company in Saigon. I drove Fords, you know, okay, Impalas. All right, I drove VIPs around. I've only met one veteran who was in a sedan car company in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I was so excited. It was like, and he lived in a hotel. I mean, you're talking, no wonder those guys don't show up at reunions or brag about what they do. Because it's like, what? I'm wearing civilian clothes. I'm living in a hotel. And I'm driving VIPs around. Eating good chow, shit. You know, I'd be embarrassed about my Vietnam service, too. Yeah, you're like, okay, I wouldn't go to a reunion with all these guys who are out there in the bush.
Yeah.
You know. And not everybody, here's the thing, not everybody who was in Vietnam. Look, the tooth-to-tail ratio was like 1 to 10 or 1 to 11. So for every trigger puller out there breaking bush, there's like 10 guys behind him in the rear making sure they can do their job.
Well,
so,
and, you know, that's the one thing I wanted to, and we got like 16 minutes. So one thing I did want to talk about is there's a pitch going out. You know, we've talked about doing some documentaries and videos, and I need to get your help on this. So we need to look at, you know, the unsung heroes in the military. You know, I mean, you know, how many times have you seen a documentary where they go in and they say, we're going to follow the life of a U.S. Army cook or a U.S. Navy dental technician? But I think that it's important to identify those jobs, all those support jobs, all those jobs that are critical. You know, you might not think that you need a dental technician until you got something wrong with your teeth, you know what I mean, and you need something made. And then you're glad they're there.
I'm glad you brought that up because in my I'm an adjunct professor for Christopher Newport University, okay, and my first class was military geography, and this fall I'm going to teach military logistics. But anyway, I had one of my R2C students was not an OIF vet. He went over during the Syria conflict.
Yeah, that's
and I'm
my
talking
son
to him, and yeah, and here's what's funny is he goes and he just like what you just said. He's like, but I was just a dental tech.
Yeah,
I wasn't important. I think that's what he said. I wasn't important because I was a dental tech. I said, yeah. So all the infantry guys are really looking down on you until they have a tooth problem, and then you're the most important person over there. Yeah, absolutely. And when I said that, he got so excited. He was impressed. I said, yeah. I mean, we can't do our job without you doing yours. Yes, we take the great risk. We get the glory. We, you know, all that. But, I mean, seriously. We can't function without all those guys in the rear.
No, I know.
Let me explain it. All right, let me explain it. Here's the theme of my college course, the theme of my book, Delivering Victory, which is way too expensive. You got to be a serious student of logistics to want to buy Delivering Victory. It's like $100, okay? Published by England. I told them it was too damn high. But anyway. There are three functions in logistics: service, supply, transportation. Okay, supply, days of supplies. All right, you advance on days of supply. When you get run out of days of supply, your advance comes to a halt. Okay, transportation. Let me tell you, armies do not run out of supplies because there's a shortage of supplies. No, they run out of supplies at the front. There's always more supplies at the rear. They just, it's a lack of transportation. But it's the routes by which we deliver that those supplies is which dictates the routes by which we advance, what we call lines of communication. Now, service. Service is what keeps men in equipment in the fight. Maintenance is a service. Dental techs, food service, medical service, all these. All right. Why is it important? Because if you study the Army of the 19th century, desertion rates were extremely high. We do not have, our Army does not have a problem with desertion because of those soldiers involved in the services, those dental techs. Yes, we make sure that the guy out there taking the risk, going out there, he gets to come back and everything he needs is taken care of. The services, those soldiers involved in the services side of logistics, the morale high of the guys that are pulling the triggers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm all for it. And, you know, I talked to Beth about that. And so we need to have a serious chat about what we need is we need access to the schools and to the military organizations to let us do those interviews.
No, actually, your biggest problem is the school, I mean, is identifying those people. And I'm telling you right now.
Well, I mean,
I paid attention. James, yeah. You knew I paid attention. I made 5 trips overseas to capture these stories and writing about it. But I'm going to tell you right now, the other historians were a few of the historians. The armor guy, Robert Cameron, he's paying attention because when I reach out, the artillery guy, Boyd Dastrup, who's retired, only a few of the historians were paying attention to what the branch is doing. The most of them were done. So you tell me, James. See, that's the problem with this idea you have for a documentary, Unsung Heroes. How do you find those unsung heroes? Do you go to find the unsung heroes?
Well, you go to
you reach out to one person. You've dealt with me, James. Your problem is you've been dealing with me, and I know all the unsung heroes of the trans. Well, I don't know all of them. There's some that escaped me, but I know the majority of the unsung heroes of the Transportation Corps. But
here's what I'm thinking.
Who else would you
know? Here's what I'm thinking about this thing. It's more of a the not so well known. You know, it's kind of like on the theme of dirty jobs. But it's like the jobs you never knew existed in the military, you know.
That's different. Yeah. That's different than your
that's
unsung
what
heroes.
I really like. You'd go to, and the unsung heroes is a good deal, too. But I think this one would be good.
It's
and
good
I think
deal
military,
if you can identify them. Okay.
Well, I mean, I've got a list of all the MOSs on the branches. I've already pulled that, you know, on all
James,
the branches.
James, you need 12 episodes. I can fill 12 episodes just from the Transportation Corps. But you're going to have to find your quartermaster isn't going to give you anything. You know,
why not?
Ordnance is probably not going to give anything. You know, so, but anyway, keep going.
Why wouldn't they do that? Here's what I'm saying is.
Because they're not paying. James, why didn't you get the Distinguished Service Cross? Why didn't you get the Silver Star while you were still over there? Because
I was
no
lucky
one
because
paying attention.
The hate shade would have been too
it
bad
goes
for
back
me.
Back to what SLA Marshall was writing about.
But
no
I'm saying,
paying attention to what happened today. They're paying attention to what happens tomorrow and the next day.
I got you. Let me finish. I think this is probably something we go through recruiting command on. We say, look, we want to ID some of these jobs. We want to go interview some of the instructors, visit the bases, do the what does it take to train to be a 13 whatever or a, you know, I don't even know the MOS's numbers like I used to know.
All
what
right,
does
James,
it take
all right,
to
James,
be a cook?
James, now, what is going – here's the issue. So our friend, Beth Garrigal, who spent her and her partner, who unfortunately died of a brain tumor, they pushed this Vietnam gun truck story, pitched it for 5 years and before the Smithsonian Channel bought it. Tell me why anyone would buy a story about AIT. All these boring AIT jobs. See, the thing is, look, for the audience out there, you know,
I teach
people about writing.
You thought the logistics show would be boring, but it's not boring, man.
No,
Dave,
what's your hook? That's my whole point.
My hook is to identify some of these additional jobs so that it will spark the interest of maybe some of these youth that would qualify for service to
say, that sounds like a recruiting. That's a recruiting advertisement, James. That's not a 30 to an hour long documentary.
But look, it is a documentary. It talks about jobs and current training skills.
James,
and here's the other thing.
Look, I know the nobility of your cause, but I'm telling you right now.
640.
Because I met with Beth. Beth came down. Beth Garrigal came down to film.
I know.
I'm trying to remember what. Oh, we had the CEO. She is such a fan of the veterans that she gives up her free time coming down and filming this stuff. But she's pitching for these guys, and the only story we have gotten pitched was the Vietnam gun truck story. She hasn't even been able to get the Smithsonian to do a follow up on Iraq gun trucks. You're sitting there going like, Vietnam gun trucks is exciting. Where do you get into the story of Iraq? She hasn't got a nibble on that. And you want someone to spend money to make a documentary about
Are you ready? You're not listening to me. See, you're just talking, but you're not listening, man. And it's like this right here.
No, James. What I'm telling you is the reality because I've been I'm the guy who's been pitching these stories for over 20 years now.
Everybody knows.
I got your story told. I got the Vietnam vet story. And
we're still pushing. And everybody in the audience saying, "Damn, let the guy finish."
Yeah, go ahead. Anyway, sorry, James. I apologize because I am like a broken record on
this
story.
Where is Father Michael at? Let me tell you. Okay, so here's the deal. You make the show, you identify the jobs that no one really knows exist in the military, but we have to do. In addition, what you do is you show how that functions within the military cycle. Now, this does a couple things. Number one, it sparks the interest of people that might want to learn about that skill set. That's probably 25% of the viewers. Then it also sparks the interest in potential employers who think, I didn't know that person went through that kind of training. Maybe our company should give them full credit because right now veterans are coming out doing these really groovy jobs, but they can't get certified or can't get jobs doing what they did in the military because the civilian employers don't fully understand what these jobs entail and how the military really functions like a Fortune 500 company. We have all these different agencies from mail.
Yeah,
parts.
All right, James, here's the deal. So pitch that to Beth and tell me how far that goes, okay? Because Beth is the one out there. She's the one who's pitching it to the networks.
Okay.
That hook, I'm telling you right now that I've been dealing with this, the hook has to be exciting. And we've had some real good nibbles that just never go anywhere, and you go, why didn't they get it? See, you get it, I get it, but, you know, yeah, I mean, seriously, like dirty jobs in the Army, seriously, that it makes sense, but the networks aren't buying it.
Yeah. Well, they might. They might if you just have to
they
know how
could,
to
pick. You know, I look at it like, okay, so you talk about the maintenance guy. Here's a mechanic. And then here's a story of a mechanic that goes out on the convoy and gets the Bronze Star or the Silver Star. I'll tell you right now, the ordnance historian probably doesn't know who got the Bronze Star, who's the hero story, okay? Because most of that branch is not paying attention. Some of them are. Some of them are. Oh, shit. EOD. Oh, gosh. There's an interesting story. And we brought in a bunch of historians, the military history detachment guys, to come in and interview them. And some asshole civilians like, well, that's classified. You can't talk about it. And he sabotaged this. We had an opportunity to really record a lot of great stories. And they sabotaged, you know, some civilian was, he was so concerned about security that these guys just clammed up. So, but the thing is, the only reason I'm pitching this is because I know Beth, and Beth has been, she's been doing her best to pitch that story, dirty jobs in the Army. And it's not selling. It's not catching. And keep in mind, her and her partner pitched the gun truck story for 5 years before, until Smithsonian Channel finally said, we're going to pay for an one show. Okay. And keep in mind, you know, just if you go on YouTube and they have these like,
we only got a minute left.
Eight segments. And they're like in the millions of the views. Go ahead. Close out the show.
I'm sorry. We've only got 54 seconds left. But yeah, we should talk about that. Maybe we bring Beth on next Friday and have her talk about this whole process. I think it'd be good to listen to that. She's cool, man. She's a real cool person. But to all you listeners out there,
she's our hero.
She's our hero. Absolutely. Love Beth. Love Beth. Love Beth. And Garrigle Productions, if you get a chance, listeners, look her up. Beth Garrigle at Garrigle. That's G-A-R-I-G-A-L Productions. And here at Continue Mission, we send you all our best wishes for a great weekend. And we thank you for listening. We ask that you please like, share our show. If you want to be a guest, just call in. God bless each and every one of you, and have a great and wonderful weekend. Good night, everybody. Good night, Rich.
Good night.